Hello and welcome to the Fisheries Podcast. Before we get started with today's episode, I'd like to say thank you to Janet Vecchio, John Kay, and Robin G for being patrons of the show. We really appreciate your contributions. Additionally, I'd like to say a personal thank you to everyone that submitted materials for the Voices of the Quarantine episode. I personally really enjoyed Julie's contribution to this podcast by getting everyone together for something collaborative. Now, without any further ado, I hope you enjoyed episode 68 of the Fisheries Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, where for as little as $1 a month, you can help out and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker. For $10 a month, you can receive a Fisheries Podcast hat, a sticker, and also be the official sponsor of the final closing statements. And for $20 a month, you'll receive all the merch mentioned before, plus be the official sponsor of each episode's guest or interview. But as always, please remember that regardless of if you become a sponsor or not, we really appreciate you listening to the show. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jim Lamer. Dr. Lamer currently works for the Illinois Natural History Survey as a large river ecologist and director of the Illinois River Biological Station. He's come full circle as INHS was where he first realized his passion for aquatic ecology and large rivers as a technician at the Great Rivers Field Station. After leaving this field station, he had the opportunity to conduct research on the Upper Mississippi River as the manager of the Kibbe Field Station at Western Illinois University. As part of his duties there, he taught courses ranging from freshwater biology and stream ecology to ichthyology and biostatistics. Additionally, he advised graduate students on projects addressing native fish predation on Asian carp, satellite and acoustic telemetry of Asian carp, early life history of Asian carp, and native fishes. He received his PhD from the University of Illinois on the prevalence, distribution, and post-zygotic success of Asian carp hybridization in the Mississippi River Basin, and both his master's and bachelor's were earned at Western Illinois on redder slider genetics in the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. His current work, he likes to combine his background in population and hybrid genetic methods with more traditional fisheries and ecological techniques to answer questions pertaining to invasive species management, feeding ecology of fishes, fish movement, and long-term community composition. So welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Oh, thanks, Brett. I'm happy to be here.
So we'll start off with this career that you've built around large river ecology, mainly in the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. What is it about these systems that keeps you curious and excited to keep coming back and learning about them?
Well, that's a good question. I'd say one of the things that really keeps my interest with large rivers is that, you know, of course, they're very complex. And so you have things like hydrology, sediment loads, temperature, available habitats, varying habitats. These are all drivers of aquatic communities, and these things are always changing. So rivers are very dynamic and complex. And I think because of that challenging aspect of it, I think that's what captivates me and keeps me interested in large rivers. In addition to that, you know, that seeing something new all the time as fisheries biologists, that's something that, you know, I think that it really kind of got a lot of us in the fisheries profession going, kind of getting that adrenaline rush or that sense of awe of seeing or experiencing something new. And that's something that large rivers, that they have so many species and so many different taxa out there that you're always bound to see something new every day.
Yeah, absolutely. I know for myself, I have definitely a shorter career than you, but I've only worked in river and stream systems, and just the amount of change that you can see from hopping in the field truck and going to a headwater site in the morning and a down Riverside in the afternoon. It's pretty incredible. What are some of the current projects that you guys are working on at the IRBS?
So at the IRBS, you know, their main foundation has been in long-term monitoring. One of our signature programs is the Upper Mississippi River Research Restoration Long-Term Monitoring Program. So this has been collecting water quality data year-round and fisheries data for almost the last 30 years, from the LaGrange Reach to the Illinois River. So this is using a variety of gears, such as hoop nets and pike nets and minnow fikes and electrofishing. This is all standardized, and then we can compare to these other trend areas that have been collecting data for the same amount of time as part of that program, such as up in Pool 4, Pool 8, Pool 13, Pool 26 in the open river of the Mississippi River, down by Cape Girardeau, and then our lonely program there on the Illinois River. In addition, we've been collecting long-term monitoring data on the entire Illinois River, a main channel border electrofishing sites, and this is part of our long-term electrofishing program. This is started back by William Sterrett back in 1957. So we've been, and we're still collecting that data today, all up and down the Illinois River. Another long-term project we have is working on the Imaquan Preserve. And so this is a Nature Conservancy restored backwater that we've been collecting data on for about the last 13 years since its restoration. This was converted from ag fields back to a semi-connected backwater habitat of the Illinois River. And so that's kind of our long-term monitoring programs and what really sets the foundation for our station in our program. And then we have a lot of other research that's going on beyond that as well. So we have some of the black carp monitoring we do. One of the kind of exciting projects we are started to work on last year is the Illinois River Waterway Lock Closure Project. So this, we're able to collaborate with multiple agencies, and we're collecting standardized data, fisheries data, on every reach of the Illinois River from all the way up to the Lockport Pool, all the way down to the Alton Pool. And we're doing that for 3 years to evaluate fish response to the closure of the locks, which is supposed to happen this year. And so we are using wave or vessel-induced covariates, such as wave amplitude, sediment resuspension, frequency and timing of barge traffic. And then since this is kind of a unique opportunity to evaluate this, since this doesn't usually happen. They don't usually close all the locks down at once. And so this is an opportunity for us to get in there and really see how barges and vessels can affect our native fish communities. And then if we move all the way over to the Mississippi River, we have our Asian carp harvest program. So we monitor Asian carp populations, we work with contracted fishermen, we use telemetry and mark recapture methods to help guide our fishing efforts to help remove Asian carp in these areas where they're not that abundant in the upper Mississippi River, and that's really from pools 14 to 16. And then all in between, there's several projects, telemetry, age and growth, that all go along with a lot of these programs we have.
That's incredible. I mean, it's full force, I'd assume, going out and doing all these different types of projects. If you could boil it down, though, what do you think has been your pet project or maybe one of your favorite ones that you've had the opportunity to see all the way from the planning stage to the fruition of your hard work afterwards?
So I was thinking about this one. I've been involved with a lot of rewarding projects. I would say the one that we're not quite across the finish line yet, but I think one of the ones that we've been working on recently, it's a little unique, and it's something that is not only the product of myself, but of a lot of the graduate students and a lot of our collaborating agencies' time and effort. This would be looking at Asian carp reproduction, early life history in the upper Mississippi River. This is kind of unique because it takes a lot of individual projects and puts them together to look at a very complex and issue, Asian carp reproduction. It's really probably the most comprehensive assessment of that in the Midwest since their introduction. And a lot of that's attributed to being able to work with all these other agencies and take all these individual projects and put them all together for a comprehensive picture. I'd say, starting from eggs, so Iowa State doing a lot of egg trawls on the tributaries, the upper Miss, moving on to even starting in the gonads where we're able to do some histological work and look at batch synchronous spawning and Asian carp, knowing that they're capable of multiple spawns per season, and then getting estimates of batch fecundity. Telemetry from Fish and Wildlife and USGS, which is showing them going up, making these large migrations up in the tributaries. A lot of larval light trap work, kind of showing where they settle out as larvae, and then showing the frequency and magnitude of those larval emergences, as well as looking at otoliths of young of year fish and detecting where the young of years are moving, looking at the size the young of years are going, and then looking at otolith microstructure to get hatch date of those, and microchemistry to look at where a lot of those young of year Asian carp were spawned or where their similar nursery habitats were. We start putting that together with a lot of the explanatory variables such as hydrology and flashy tribs. We're really able to paint a very comprehensive picture of Asian carp reproduction. So I'd say to date, just being able to see the hard work of my students going towards something like this, and everything coming together to really get a finer grasp and understanding of a very complex issue has been one of the most rewarding projects I've worked on so far.
That's cool. I know for me, I have been at Iowa State for a couple of different cohorts of students that are working on different aspects of Asian carp reproduction dynamics. And to see a big collaborative effort sort of coming to a head, I think will interest a lot of folks who have been putting in a lot of time and effort into trying to get a handle on the invasion front and also, how do we take this information and move forward into the future. And it's been great to hear about your current research, but also you have a little bit of a non-traditional start maybe in fisheries work where you did some genetics for the red-eared slider. Were you interested in genetics prior to this project, or was it something that you sort of happened to come across and found it super interesting?
It's kind of one of those things I just kind of fell into. I had no interest in genetics prior to starting that. All I was really interested in was being outside, working plants, animals, something in the natural resources. My dad was a forester. My brother is a forester. I was at one time thinking about being a forester. And when I went to undergrad at WIU, I was in the honors program, and they had an honors thesis or an honors research program. And with that, then we would have to select an advisor, and there was a herpetologist there, Mike Romano, at the time. And at that time, I really liked snakes, and anything too. So I'll go talk to him, and he just happened to be a geneticist or population geneticist. So he's like, "Well, I got a project that you can do, but it's a genetics project." And so I was like, "Yeah, sure, try it." And then the rest is history. So I was kind of working with allozymes and looking at gene flow and red-eared sliders, mainly around one of the dams there on the Mississippi River. And then later down, it kind of encapsulated some of the work I was doing down at the Great Rivers Field Station as well. And it kind of evolved since then. And of course, genetics is a rapidly evolving field, and sometimes it's hard to balance the ecology and the genetics. And so, with a lot of the newer techniques and things, I rely a lot on my colleagues who that's all they do as collaborators to assist. So.
Yeah, I think it's cool that in your current work, you're able to combine some traditional fisheries techniques and management strategies to this foundational background that you have in genetics, because I think sometimes those two realms don't always communicate as effectively as they could because of the maybe the difference in terms or jargon or just research questions. So I think that's interesting. You've been able to combine both. And then I came across a photo of you covered from what looked like head to toe in mud, holding potentially a snake and maybe even one of those red-eared sliders that you worked on. Just for some context, can you describe what was going on in that photo and maybe how it related to whatever research you were working on at the time?
Yeah, the quick answer was there's a lot going on in that photo. but no, that was actually a pretty fun night. So it kind of takes me back to when I worked at Great Rivers Field Station. I was down there for 7 years. During the daytime, I either worked on water quality or aquatic vegetation or macroinvertebrates, fisheries, or one of the ATREPs they had down there. And that was kind of the daytime job, and throughout different years had different duties. But in the evenings and a lot of times in the mornings, I would work with their herpetologists. A lot of times it was a volunteer basis. So at that night, particular night, we went out and they were draining one of the lakes, Stump Lake down there. They were drawing it down and it was congregating fish and at the same time congregating water snakes. And so, more than any major research objective, we just went out there because we wanted to catch a bunch of water snakes. We did scale clip a lot of them. We also, took out vent length and some genetic samples. But I think we ended up catching about 30 water snakes that night, and various things. So the herpetologist at the time was John Tucker, who's since retired, but I really worked a lot with John. I think since the time I was there in 7 years, we trapped somewhere over 30,000 turtles. He's real big into reproductive ecology of turtles too. And so I think that one summer we induced maybe about 700 female sliders and hatched out about 7,000 eggs or so. So we'd spend to the wee hours of the morning just drying off, weighing, measuring eggs and writing on them with a Sharpie and hatching them out in big things of vermiculite. That was a lot of my life when I worked down at Great Rivers, is just in the evenings and after work and before work, doing a lot of that work. Funny story about that picture is that I was asked by my sister-in-law to give a reptile presentation to her fifth grade class. And so I took about all the 30 of those water snakes and just reached in and grabbed a big ball of them. They're all really writhing and biting. And those kids are probably about 30 years old now, but they're probably still in therapy. So.
Oh yeah. I never did go outside after I had that one guy come to my fifth grade class and show me a ball full of water snakes. But on the other hand, maybe you inspired someone to go out and count turtle legs and look for snakes just like you. So
yeah, you never know.
So in terms of teaching, we mentioned that you've taught a wide variety of courses. And, we've all been there. It's an 8 a.m. and maybe some eyes are glazed over, or you're talking about demographics and population modeling. People kind of tune out. But did any one of those classes stand out as a fan favorite or one that you had a lot of students sort of engage with?
So I think for myself personally, I had a favorite for me. And as demented as it sounds, I really enjoyed teaching biostats. That was mainly because it forced me to really get in and learn how to analyze data correctly. The students learned things along the way, but I mean, it really made me, I think, a better scientist. And it made me a better mentor to my students. I actually found out I enjoyed stats and, still wanting to continue to learn and, one, to improve myself as a scientist as well. I think as far as students are concerned, I think maybe some of the more engaging courses that I taught were some of the field courses. So Mississippi River Ecology or Streams Ecology, Freshwater Biology or Fisheries Techniques. These are about 90% in the field. And learning in the field, and I think students, you know, being able to get the hands-on experience. And since I'd worked at the survey and worked, you know, with agencies, I was pretty familiar with, you know, a lot of the techniques they used and a lot of the sampling that actually goes on. So it's a little bit beyond, you know, what you might learn in the textbook, but what you might actually be expected to do as you move on to, you know, a job in this profession. And so I think in that aspect, I think students really got a lot out of those courses. I was able to recruit a couple of grad students from those courses that I don't think had previously really been interested in that. You know, one that maybe stands out would be fisheries techniques. This is one that we try to find agencies and folks around that are doing research around our area, and we would tag along for teachable moments, and we would assist. Whether it be MDC doing their lake sturgeon trot lines and acoustic tag implementation, or them doing their Missouri mini trawl, us going and assisting Illinois DNR with their unified method and some of their large commercial seine holes. One that I always included in that class was the guys at Rathman Lake, which is not too far from you. Mm-hmm. Those guys were cool enough to let me bring a boat over. And then I'd stay 5 to 10 days, depending on the years. I'd stay in their bunkhouse, and then students would come over. They'd spend the night. That night, we'd stay out till 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning netting walleye, and they'd go back to the hatchery. They all get opportunities to help strip and the walleye and fertilize the eggs and you know, put them in hatching jars. And the next morning, then they get to strip the males. And so I think, you know, those sort of experiences and hands-on experiences, I think, were probably the most engaging for the students. And it kind of gets away from that 8 a.m. Head on your desk scenario you were talking about.
Yeah, I know both sides of that coin are pretty important moving forward. And like you said, it's some of those things that make you a better scientist that are pretty invaluable. So I always think it's kind of interesting, but a intro to logic, one of the philosophy classes that I took during an undergrad, I feel like really helped me look at study questions and read papers with a little bit more of knowledgeable skepticism, if that makes any sort of sense. But sometimes it's not the flashier courses that, you know, sort of progress your scientific path, I guess. So you've advised numerous grad students, multiple of which I've had the pleasure of seeing at scientific conferences and around the Midwest. I know we talked about your research at INHS, but what were some of the study questions your lab at Western Illinois were addressing?
So I'd say, you know, the majority were, you know, revolved around large rivers, Illinois, Mississippi River, of course. And so, yeah, they really range from, you know, diet studies, looking at Asian carp as forage for native fishes, younger beer Asian carp, as well as adult Asian carp, you know, looking at blue catfish diets, just looking at diet composition, Mississippi River and Illinois, predator species in general, stable isotope stuff. Have done a lot of aging growth stuff as well. So one very large collaborative project that one of the students is presenting at Catfish 2020 next week is looking at biochronology and vital rates of catfish and drum over 7 Illinois rivers. So leveraging all the partners of our long-term electrofishing program, we're able to get samples from all these guys and then look at growth associated with different environmental variables of these different rivers on a yearly basis, looking at year class strength, mortality. Then other traditional growth studies on Asian carp, looking at young of year otolith microstructure of Asian carp, as well as other larval fishes in the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. Snapping turtle demographics of Illinois. We had a student that was really interested in herps, and we had a project from Illinois where she'd go around Illinois, and she was doing some life tables and looking at some harvest scenarios with snapping turtles. Otolith microchemistry projects of adult, mainly Asian carp, and even younger viewer Asian carp as well. Mainly looking at passage of some of the dams up there. Also had some telemetry projects. Dominique finishing her project. She was looking at frequency and timing of paddlefish passage through some of the pinch point dams on the Mississippi River, mainly Lock and Dams 14 and 15, and also habitat overlap with Asian carp. And then we were also doing some kind of experimental satellite telemetry work on the Upper Illinois River using GPS tags on carp. That's something we worked real closely with SurTrack to develop those tags to help inform some of the contracted removal that's going on up there, as well as some of the acoustic telemetry we have going with Asian carp in the Upper Illinois River too. So, and then some gear comparison stuff, larval fish, looking at best gears for larval fish, looking at gill net size selectivity for Asian carp, and I'm sure I'm missing a few, but I think that's the gist of it.
So. Yeah, so in essence, just about anything that you can do on a large river system.
Yeah, any question that interests us, we're not afraid to tackle it. So.
Well, that's great. So you've described in detail all the different projects you've been working on, but what do you find yourself doing when you're not researching these large rivers? What does a Saturday look like if you had a perfect weather and some free time?
I'd say anymore, most of the time spending time with my wife and two young boys. And so trying to get them out and get them as dirty as I was in that picture you saw is always a good Saturday, trying to get them out fishing and things. I'd say that occupies most of my time around here. I'm also a volunteer fire department officer for the Warsaw Fire Department. So that takes some of my time here and there. And a few times every year, our family has a Christmas tree farm that, our siblings, we go down and do a lot of that as well. So a lot of the tree trimming and tree planting and, a lot of upkeep of that throughout the year.
Very cool. And what do you think your favorite place that you've ever traveled outside of the Midwest has been?
Well, in case my mother-in-law is listening to this, Seattle area is great. my in-laws live just a little bit north of Seattle. And, now that the boys are getting to the age that, they're really liking to explore and they're understanding things that, we've been taking them tide pooling the last couple of times and it's just been a blast. So, going out there, seeing a marine environment and something a little different and getting to let my boys experience that and be there with them when they do. So it's always been good.
Yeah, I know coming from South Carolina, I definitely miss some of the saltwater adventures that I was able to have during the summer sometimes. So that's great that they actually get to see the ocean. I know there's some students at Iowa State that literally have never been to the beach before or seen the ocean, which is just a big paradigm shift from where I grew up. So, I guess now the, what we say, the difficult part of the interview is over, where you have to think about complex answers to questions and, we can transition into our final sort of closing statements that we like to discuss with each of our guests. And we always start with the same question with what is your favorite fish?
I have to go with bowfin on that one. Not just because it's a tough fish that demands respect, but it's one of the first river fish I ever caught. And, being in high school and catching a fish out of a backwater there of the river, a bowfin is a very interesting one. I had no idea what it was. It's they're pretty unique. Seeing those teeth, it's been my fish ever since, I think. So.
That's awesome. I just interviewed Dr. Solomon David not too long ago. So if he's listening to this episode when it comes out, he will be very appreciative of your answer. He's definitely trying to set the record straight when it comes to primitive fishes and the idea of trash fishes and things like that. So.
Oh, absolutely.
So what would be your dream job or location?
Well, I think location, I'm pretty happy being around large rivers. I think being in the Midwest and being close to family and being around rivers is what I love. So I think, and then as far as dream job, I think I found a home here at Illinois River Biological Station and work with some great people and, you know, got a lot of freedom to pursue our research interests and got a great team there at the station to, you know, shoot ideas off of. And I think I'm living it. So,
well, that's great to hear. Moving forward, if money were not an issue and you were able to get some stakeholders' deep pockets opened up, what is one project that you would ideally love to tackle at the INHS?
Boy, I guess if money is not an issue, you know, I think potentially, you know, buying up a lot of levee districts, you know, increasing riparian buffers, reducing sediment load to the rivers, and, you know, using, opening up a lot of these levee districts as, you know, as basically to regain floodplain lakes all up and down the Illinois Mississippi rivers. Those would be several big experimental units that then we could then look at the effects of opening up that laterally connected habitat.
And the streams that we see in northeastern Iowa with the research that I'm doing too. And I think my answer when I was a guest on the show is to try and do some large scale habitat improvement for some of these places and try and restore some riparian corridors. So I can only imagine what it would improve at a scale like that. Lastly, if you could boil down the message that you try and convey to your students over the years that you've been teaching, or maybe some employees that you advise at IRBS, what is one lasting point or principle that if you could have programmed in their head, what would that be?
You know, I think never pass up an opportunity to gain, you know, firsthand experience. And I think ultimately to be brave, whether it's, you know, to volunteer for something you're not that comfortable with, but, or to approach someone in this field that, you know, might be, you know, very well seasoned. You know, one thing I've learned is that, you know, in our profession that most of the folks are pretty approachable and really pretty good people and willing to help. So I think just taking a chance and being brave and putting yourself out there, I think can only lead to good things.
Yeah, that's perfect and a great way to have an optimistic view for the rest of your day after listening to the show. I'd like to say thank you for tuning in to today's episode. I do want to remind everyone about the Patreon page, and if you feel inclined to help us out, head on over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast to become a sponsor and get some cool fish pod merch. If you'd like to get a hold of me or any of the other co-hosts of the show, you can find us on Twitter at fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or just a good old-fashioned email. The handle is feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it directly from Spotify, or you can go to thefisheriespodcast.com. The podcast is sponsored by Podbean, and you can find all of our archived episodes on the website. I'm Brett Kelly. Once again, thank you for listening to the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, never pass up on an opportunity.